outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey. The God Journey.
Well, I had a great weekend this weekend with the youngins.
Ah, you had another Camp Jacobson with the grandkids.
It's been a while since we've had Camp Grandma and Grandpa. I mean, we only had two of them, the older ones working and doing other things, so she stayed home and took care of things. But we had the two younger ones, and I tell you, it makes Zoe's day. Zoe absolutely will not separate herself from those children while they're here. And she sleeps with them. She, yes. When I go for a walk in the morning, she kind of looks at them, looks at me, looks at the door. She says, I don't know what to do. And then she finally comes and goes with me. And then we, then as soon as we leave, she's turning around looking back at the house. I want to go back. I want to go back.
Wow.
She adores those children very much. And we had a great time with them. It's been a while since we've had one of these. A couple of days anyway, of hanging out with the grandkids. And they're getting older, so we're more and more precious. As we know, this time in their life is they're moving on. The younger one's talking about now getting a job, and or the middle one. So,
how old are your grandkids?
18, 15, and 12.
Okay.
So yeah. 12-year-old still, and the 15-year-old, they're really nice hanging out with Grandma and I. So we had a great time with them. And that was fun. And then Saturday morning got word that my dad had passed away. So that was kind of a, that was just as Camp Grandma and Grandpa was starting. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But we didn't let it overshadow. He's been ready to go home for quite a while. And know his suffering's over. So. Oh, that's really good. Getting a lot of condolences. And I've been ready to say goodbye for a long time to my dad. So I've had closure with him at various times. And I mean, every time I left him, we'd visit him up in the mountains. Every time I left, I didn't give a final goodbye as far as he would know. Because I was never sure. We'd gone a few months at his age, if he would be alive, I'd ever see him alive again. So I was always saying things to him that I would love him to know as things wound down. So. Yeah, that puts Sarah and my generation now. All of our parents are gone, so we're kind of kind of the top of the food chain, so to speak, with our generation anyway. I guess that's true when you get to be about 70-ish.
yeah, that tends to be the theme in general.
So that's where we are. How about you? Getting everything packed up and ready to go? Got a great place to move into when you get up there? And
we do. Yeah, we through some really cool God style connections, we were able to meet an amazing family out of Columbus, Ohio, and they have a guest home that they're allowing Jess and I to rent from them. And it's a gorgeous spot. It's on 6 acres and has views of the mountains. And it's going to be a wonderful place for us to be able to land and rest as we really get our feet kind of settled into the community and figure out what it is that God has for us in this new adventure, in this new place. So very thankful for that.
Getting all your curriculum set up, are you?
I am. I've been working on classes. I'm 2.5 classes in. So they had me build these classes from the ground up. So I had 4 different, actual different classes, not different sections, 4 different classes that I had to build from ground zero. And so it's been a full summer getting that content put together and
selling your house and getting ready to move and everything else.
Correct.
Got plenty on your plate. We've still managed to get a few podcasts ahead. Look at us.
That's amazing. I know.
Yeah.
So best thing you heard this week?
You know what? I'm going to let you go first because I'm afraid once we get in this, we'll never get out of it. But
well, I had a great best thing that I heard this week. My daughter and I, Eliana, my older one, she's 3, and we were playing make-believe in the living room. And so I walk in and she had all of her stuffed animals and they were hidden. And she said, I want you to be the monster and to try to find the stuffed animals. So I said, okay, I'll be the monster. I'll try to find the stuffed animals for you. So I'm looking for the stuffed animals. Well, she had left a elephant out, like a little stuffed elephant out. And so I went and grabbed the stuffed elephant and I start to play like I'm eating the stuffed elephant. And she screams at the top of her lungs, no, daddy, don't eat the elephant. Take the baby. So it was one of those hilarious pauses of, I might need to help my daughter understand and prioritize human life a little bit better.
she has a stuffed animal and she has a baby sister. It's easy to understand why she would want the stuffed elephant, right?
Oh my gosh. I could not keep it together. I was dying laughing as she's yelling at me to not take the elephant, but to take the baby.
Well, so you didn't ignore the elephant in the room. That must be your training.
I did not ignore the elephant in the room. That's correct. I went right after that elephant, that blue elephant in the room.
That's pretty cool. All righty. I've got something that it's provocative and very insightful. And it says this: we live in a time when the good faith of peoples is doubted more than ever before. Expressions throwing doubt on the trustworthiness of each other are bandied back and forth. We cannot continue in this paralyzing mistrust. If we want to work our way out of the desperate situation in which we find ourselves, another spirit must enter the people. We must approach them in the spirit that we are human beings, all of us, and that we feel ourselves fitted to feel with each other, to think and will together in the same way.
Ooh.
That's provocative on the face of it. Let me tell you when that was written. 1958.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Oh, my.
And that's the 50s we hearken back to as, you know, a gentler time. At least those of us who are white do. If you're not white, the 50s were not great. I get that. But the 50s, we seem to be more of a homogenous, harmonized culture. Our politics were, there were differences of opinion, but they weren't violent like today. Mm-hmm. This was actually spoken by Albert Schweitzer.
Really?
In a speech in Norway, a book came out titled Peace or Atomic War. 1958, in which that quote was inserted. Wow. And I think about now, 50 years later, 60? Yeah, 60 years later. The polarity we have now and the doubting, the trustworthiness of each other, the accusations, all, oh my gosh, the desperate situation we find ourselves. That's crazy to think how different. What would he say about today? If he were alive to look at the animosity and the tribal warfare that goes on between political parties and nations and worlds. And I mean, this obviously he had in mind the atomic bomb when he's writing in 58, because it's a thing called peace and or atomic war. He's, those are really the options. And now we're right back there again. He's going to find peace, or not just what Russia might do if they lose to Ukraine, but now you've got some half-baked dictators with atomic weapons as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is the real up podcast right here. We're going to really bring people up today.
Oh, man.
I was going to say, the thing that intrigued me about that, I've been listening to a podcast called The End of the World with Josh Clark. And a friend of mine recommended it, said she was listening to it, and it was really interesting. And that's, I'm looking for something to, different to listen to, so I put it on. And this is not a Christian approach to the world. This is not a Hal Lindsey, you know, marking the dates or anything. This is a guy who talks about the existential risks that humanity confronts in the next 100 to 150 years. And he starts out by saying, for us to be an intelligent species, and probably the only one in the universe, if there are other intelligent species out there, we don't know about them, despite the fact that someone said in Congress there's a non-human biological something in some spacecraft. That's pretty much going to be debunked, I'm pretty sure. But in any case, we don't have, he starts from the premise that we have not found intelligent life beyond Earth. And so either there isn't out there, or they haven't gotten to the place of interstellar communication or travel or anything like that. And we're just coming up on the cusp of that. So what he's saying is there's either no civilization out there, or there's no civilization that's got to where we are technologically that has survived. Which is another, he talks about the great filter, the way that when you get this much technology, and then this is where he kind of goes into the end of the world. How many existential risks there are in our culture right now, and how many of those are human born? That humanity has the capacity to make itself extinct. It's just drilled down into a number of interesting things that when I look at the world and the state of the world, I think we're as close to the kinds of things Scripture talks about that would preclude the end of the age. And I'm not talking about the, you know, Antichrist, kind of all those things, though some people probably would identify different people to be Antichrist today, depending on what tribe you're in. But I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about the makeup of the world, the hostility, the idea, can civilization exist another 100 years if God doesn't intervene in some way? And this was, I found myself really intrigued Well, almost every aspect of this, the existential risks, are nuclear. It's what Albert Schweitzer was talking about. Mm-hmm. They're virological, which we just saw with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. There's an untold number of labs around the world that are dealing with gain of function research into biological entities. Yeah. And what he's saying is any one of those, intentionally or unintentionally, lets one of the really virulent strains out, and we could be extinct. We could start an atomic war, a nuclear war, and we would be extinct. We could, and he talks about the super collider reactors and the potential for something unpredicted to happen inside that could create a black hole and swallow the Earth, which is, yeah, incredibly rare possibility, but mathematically not uncertain.
Yeah.
Or not certain. And so I just, oh. And there were so many things that they said in that context that I think it'd be fun to explore. One, they talk about one man acting alone now could render humanity extinct. One man, whether it pushes a nuclear button, whether it lets something out of a lab. So that there's that risk. And mm-hmm. the more people who have this technology at their disposal, AI is one of those things they talk about mm-hmm. could certainly end human existence. One is just the climate change, which is kind of what we're all doing together. And this, there's a whole section on what they call the tragedy of the global commons. The global commons is what we all hold together. It's water, air, it's resources. It's what belongs to all of us together, even though capitalism, and I'm not against capitalism, so don't anybody call me communist, but capitalism portions that out to the victor gets the spoils. So whoever the mm-hmm. most powerful gets whatever they want, and other people are left without. And that's just too bad because you weren't there first, and you weren't more powerful when you got there, so you couldn't take it away. So the idea that we all have things in common, and then he says this, as long as what we have in common is abundant, we seem to share it fine. Mm-hmm. When it becomes scarce, then the human tendency is to take as much for myself as I can get without worrying about who's getting left out. And no one considers, the provocative thing, no one considers that what we hold in common, we not only hold in common with everybody alive on the planet today, but with our progeny, with our children, with the future generations who have yet to be born. Those resources are their resources, which is why the push for going to Mars or going to other planets, trying to get our seed out there somewhere else in case something happens here. And part of it's we got to find more resources. There aren't enough resources here for everybody to live like we do in the West. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist on the planet. So this is why the Roman Empire, we always think, why did the Roman Empire conquer the world? Because they ran out of resources where they were. So we'll go get those people and take their, we'll get the Greeks, we'll go get the Arabs, we'll go get the English and Germans. And it was all about increasing their, because they used up all they had.
Yeah.
And so now we got to get more. So what do you think of all that? It's just, it's interesting. I know you're younger to think about the existential risks that confront us, but it's made me really think and pray and hold this before God of what are we doing? Because I would think the end of the world might come, not because man does something, I don't believe that, but it's going to come a point at which God can't let mankind go on to another day or we won't be here.
Yeah.
And this is not a doomsday podcast. He's not saying these risks are imminent and surely going to happen. He's mostly giving the hope that we can get through the 150 years. But if we do, we may be the first intelligent species that ever has. So the challenge is huge. Let's be aware of it. And then let's find a way to talk about it and get through.
Man, it's really interesting that you bring this up because the last couple of weeks, I've been working on my class called Sociology Problems in Our Culture Today. And it has been so interesting unpacking just the different topics or different areas of social challenges that are not only the United States is facing, but the world is facing globally. And I mean, we look at some of the things that we've looked at are, you know, renewable resources. We've looked at I looked at education. We looked at the family system. We looked at economy. We looked at consumerism and the impact of consumerism on on overall society. And, you know, and one of the big ones that we're going to drill into is whether or not the United States Western perspective, this democratic perspective, are its days numbered. As capitalism and other, as social media, and as we're in this space where there's lots of things that are threatening our cultural experience and the way that we function in our cultural experience, what would it look like for us to even be able to move that in a different direction? Because, you know, the United States is a social experiment. It's a sociological experiment. And we're trying to figure out, okay, is it possible for us to work our way through this or not? And man, when you talk about the idea of the scarcity mindset and the ones with power, the ones that are willing to compromise their morals, their integrity, their character in order to gain more assets, more resources, more power, is it worth it? And is it, you know, or is it worth being able to take those steps to get to the top? And will we even recognize our society, our culture, our own individual self when we do reach the top? If we do, it's, man, we are living in very intriguing times right now.
Yeah. What I love about this podcast I've listened to and thinking through these things is that you see it in the macro and the whole, what could happen out there, but mm-hmm. also a lot of the stuff goes down to the micro level. Like, I have an awareness of how I'm impacting the world? And we don't. I mean, I know climate change is a hot topic, and, you know, people hate to love it depending on what tribe you're in, obviously. But I don't think you can be a reasonable human being and not look around the world and say, we are caught in the most extreme kinds of weather patterns and climate things that have ever happened in the history of the world, of recorded history of the world. Now, we've had ice ages, we've had other things. So it's not totally unprecedented. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the impact that humanity has on boiling its own nest is undeniable, just by how much resources we take. And I know there's some that argue, well, it has nothing to do with global warming. It would have happened anyway. And maybe it would have. I'm not saying I know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. But you cannot deny that we are in weather extremes of flooding or drought or, you know, that we've ever had, or heat across the U.S. this summer, which says, it's summer, it's always hot. Well, that's not exactly what's going on, but some people want to retreat to that. And one of the things he discusses is our inability as humans to look at wider existential challenge. We're just trying to get through today, feed my family, do the work I need to do. We get really down to the day-to-day that we don't have the capacity to think of existential risks that I don't feel like I can control the outcome of. I can stop driving my car, but it's not going to change whatever the impact is having on the atmosphere from all the fossil fuels we're burning, you know, whatever. So rather than contemplate, oh my gosh, that we could be destroying ourselves, we just don't think about it. And I think there are people I know, particularly from the conservative Christian kind of thing that I've been a part of and know a lot of my friends live in. Mm-hmm. And I have some attachment to it as well. There's just complete wanting to deny, not discuss anything having to do with climate change, or because, quite honestly, Democrats have monetized it for their own business cronies and all that. So they don't have the integrity on this issue any more than the people on the right do. But while we're fighting over that, as Albert Schweitzer talked about in the 58, our world gets worse. And I think in a microcosm of the people in Kenya that we helped, they went from being nomadic. You can be nomadic and you don't have to worry too much about hygiene because you're moving on every day or two. Mm-hmm. Then you start settling down and now you're spoiling the nest you live in. And just the capacity of humanity in the world, the number of humans alive on the planet versus the number of resources the planet has versus how many are willing to take off the top as much as they can at the expense of others who have nothing, weren't here when it happened, weren't here when things were divided up. And just water rights in California, I mean, they gave out water rights over 100 and some odd years ago, and now certain groups completely left out of the disbursement of that. But those who have are not willing to give up because economically it's not in their interest to do it. Hey, look at all those things, and I just go, oh God, I don't know how you bring this to its end. I don't know, but it seems to me that something's got to happen. Either divine intervention. One of the things they talk about is techno-optimism.
Okay.
The thought that somebody will invent something that will get us out of this. So yeah, somebody's going to invent the carbon dioxide, monoxide eater or whatever that can just stick it in the atmosphere and suck out all the bad stuff and the planet just rehabilitates itself. Think about all the ways we could just get saved from all this tomorrow and it would all be different, which it could. I mean, it really could. But techno-optimism is also disappointing at times. It may not have the answers. And what is God going to do? When Sarah and I were reading Revelation recently, one of the things that God says, Eugene Peterson's words, I've had enough. It may be God having to say to humanity, you've had enough. I really, you know, when you watch your kids try and work out something and they're kind of fighting and negotiating and you're kind of going, okay, hope you guys can get to this until one of them's got the other one down on the ground and beating them over the head with their favorite toy. And you go, okay, I cannot let you keep doing this, right?
Yeah.
And where does God intervene? And I you know, it may be in the next 10 years, it may be in the next 200 years. I'm not offering a time deadline, but I look at all this with some interesting musings going, wow. Mm-hmm. This is really a unique time in the history of humans on the planet. Not till 1946 with the atomic bomb did we have the power to make ourselves extinct. Now we do.
Yeah.
Now we do. And it's not just that, but AI could be that. And the virological labs that we have all over the world, they could be that. Interesting.
Well, and even, I mean, looking at some of the policies, like I don't know if you're familiar with an author named Jack Carr.
I'm not.
He's a former special forces and has gone into authoring, and he wrote a couple of books that have been turned into TV shows and movies and stuff, and very, very good author, especially if you like that genre of book. And yet it's been really interesting watching the projection of his books. Like some of the first three I loved, and then they started getting more and more, there's more and more despair, more and more politics were getting involved, more and more. And it's like, man, you could hear the discouragement and the despair of somebody who had risked his life on a repeated basis for this idea of America. Now he's retired. Now he's back in the United States trying to live in the midst of that. And there's just a lot of discouragement that he's wrestling with. And one of the things that he explores the idea of in one of his books is that exact thing of a lab where something gets out in an area, and is there, what would be the policy? Would, for example, would it get so extreme to where the government says, for the sake of the United States, we're going to bomb this entire city and wipe out the entire population that's in that city to keep the disease from spreading? Could they go there? Would they go there?
Yeah.
You know, and just those ideas that we're playing with things that could mean our extinction. And then as we begin to continue to go down those roads, the adjustments that would be required in order to backtrack from a mistake with, say, for example, some of these super drug or super bugs that we're exploring. You know, it gets more and more extreme. So, you know, for example, with AI, what are the steps that would have to be made in order to backtrack once AI is set completely free, has its full advantage to do and go where it wants to go? I don't know. I have no idea. What would, you know, like social media, what would it take to backtrack from some of the incredibly devastating challenges that social media has posed to our culture and to our society? Not to mention our youth, and not to mention, you know, the challenges that are now being seen in young people, largely due to the component of social media and how it plays a role in their life. Man, I don't know.
How much destruction is really caused by the whole idea of unintended consequences? Like, if we knew what social media was going to do, would we have chosen to go down this road? We might have, because of the profit motive behind the companies doing it, but... Mm-hmm. There's no ability to see where this would go. The fact is that information is at your fingertips. You could be in communication with people all over the world. Oh, it sounds great.
Yeah.
But then the mental health things that it did, particularly to young people, but even older ones as well. Yeah. It's just unintended. You just couldn't see it.
Yeah.
I think about that in a lot of interpersonal relationships. Somebody tells a lie. Somebody tries to defend something here. And then all of a sudden, the relationship goes down a road no one intended. like the political thing. I don't think anybody would have chose to have an America as politicized as we are, with media outlets supporting one side or the other. And so now we can't even do justice anymore because it's got a political agenda behind it all. No one knows that. It makes me think of my dad. My dad had these two dogs when we were kids, and we'd be walking out in the vineyard or whatever, checking water or doing something. And one of them would come around the road. One dog looked in there and bark. And then the other one turned and bark. And they both start barking. They run down the road like they saw a rabbit, and there was no rabbit. But they have accelerated each other into this spasm of, I've got to do something. And I've seen that happen in personal relationship. A lie here, a rumor, a belief. And then it just keeps amping up. And you sit back as an outsider and you go, wow, that's, no one would have gone there where it ended up from the beginning.
Yeah.
But these steps that we didn't foresee, even the impact humanity has on the world, just the amount of resources, no one sees that back then. It's a land of plenty and plenty of resources for everybody. You just have to be industrious and work hard and get your share of the pie. And we don't realize that that's gotten beyond our capacity to handle it in a good way. And so this is one of the things said. I'm going to quote a couple of things. I'd love to hear your take on these things.
Yeah.
Taking all of this together, everything seems to point to the coming century or two as the most dangerous period in human history. And as much as is riding on us, we have a lot going against us. We are our own worst enemy when it comes to existential risks. We come preloaded with a lot of biases that keep us from thinking rationally. We prefer not to think about unpleasant things like the sudden extinction of our species. Our brains aren't wired to think ahead to the degree that existential risks require us to. One of the things he said, to deal with existential risks will never fit into a 4-year election cycle. Requires too much forward thinking. And this, the problem money poses where existential risks are concerned is that humanity has shown that we are willing to sell out our own best interests and the interests of others for money and market share. Or more commonly, that we're willing to stand by and let others do it. With existential risk, greed would be a fatal flaw. Everything from the tobacco industry to the fossil fuel industry to the antifreeze industry to the infant formula industry, all of them have a history of avarice, of frequently and consistently putting money before well-being, and on a massive and global scale. How can we expect change when money is just as tied to the experiments and technology that carry and existential risk? that could lead to some pessimism maybe about the future, eh?
It really could. And I think, again, if ever there was a time that it's being reiterated that money is the root of all evil, I don't think there's ever been a more bold expression of that in humanity. Because the challenge is that we're moving at such a fast pace because of this, again, the scarcity mindset of, if we aren't on the cutting edge, we're going to get left out. We're going to become obsolete. We're going to be left behind. And then we become irrelevant. We're not a shot caller. Now we don't have any power. Now we don't have any influence. And yet there's a lot of life and wisdom to be found in the pause. Because there could have been people asking at the front end of internet, at the front end of social media, at the front end of AI, should we be doing this? Should we go down this road? Even though we can, should we go down this road? Or should we pause? Should we create some buffer in here to really seek wisdom on asking some questions that might be uncomfortable or that might take us into some of the flaws of our humanity? And those spaces that we are vulnerable, you know, we've talked a lot about a lot of different areas of human expression, whether it be education or the religious institutions, government, where this seductive allure that twists us to the point that we're willing to sacrifice not only ourselves and our character and our identity, but also even the hope of future generations for the sake of our own well-being, our own self-interest. That's a spooky spot to be in.
Yeah, that's our track record, right? No one ever stops the possibility of great return saying, you know, this probably isn't a good idea for X, Y, or Z reason, you know? And if AI, someone's talking about AI managing a business, could an AI manage a business? And yeah, if you program it to only care about the bottom line, the amount of the amount of information it can process and choices it can make, when it's all about the bottom line, it's not about the human element of, is it right to do what we're doing? And is it good for the whole of America or the whole of the world? Instead of just, is it good for me? Because I'll make a profit.
Yeah.
And I think there were people in social media that asked those questions. And there's people with AI asking it today. The problem is in a culture where the freedom in it, and that's Western civilization mainly, not just America. But then, yeah, some responsible people say, let's slow this down. But then you've got Lex Luthor in his cave somewhere in the world who goes, I don't care what the rest of them are doing. I can do something so horrible that I can own the world with this thing.
Yeah.
And that's humanity's bent. It doesn't take all of us to go down that road. It just takes a few of us to go down that road. And again, the unintended consequences of the cans we open, we don't know what's in there. We are very optimistic about the upside of things. We don't always see the downside of things.
So where does kingdom come into this, right? Like where does God's, his viewpoint, especially one of the things that we talked about earlier on, and it only been almost a year ago now, is just the thing that came out of the prayer group with you guys in regards to gazing with God, like gazing at the world, sitting beside him and gazing at the world through his eyes. What I wonder what he's seeing right now. In regards to, you know, the all these existential crises that we are facing, and a lot of it hinging on the choices that a couple of generations make, what do you think he sees?
And I don't know that what we're seeing goes to there. I think what we're seeing is never before will there be a need for brothers and sisters to truly put their hope in Jesus and follow him to navigate these things. Because the big picture items of, can we restrain AI? Can we do this? Can we change climate stuff? That's so out of all of our power, right? But can each of us, each one of us, learn to lean into that space that the Holy Spirit has for us? Or if existential risks are coming, if weather patterns are going to get even worse and the destruction, we're going to run out of money to rebuild everything that gets destroyed. And now scarcity is going to set in. Do I have a trust in Jesus that is bigger than what the world can deal to me? Or is my quote unquote trust in Jesus really vested in the economic enterprise or system I'm in where I generally get my share out and me and my family, we're okay.
Yeah.
And I do think what it encourages me to, we've grown up, my generation, probably us boomers, and I know people are tired of listening to boomers, but, you know, we've been the most selfish, and I've said this before, the most selfish generation that's ever existed. We've taken everything off the table. Government's the same way. Run up debt to no concern about who gets to pay it off down the road. We buy votes, and Republicans and Democrats have done this. Yeah. So each points their finger at the other, but man, When Obama took over from Bush, it's bailout Wall Street, right? That continued. And then when Biden takes over from Trump, then it's all just throw money at the pandemic, man. Throw money at unions, throw money everywhere, trillions of dollars to screw up our economy. And no one stopped and said, why are we doing this? Because everybody in Washington that does it knows we're doing it to buy votes. Now that could all lead, even this conversation, many people are going, okay, this is not good news. This is the time to go on the adventure of what does it mean to follow Jesus? What happens if some existential risk begins to unfold? Do I have a place inside of Jesus, whether I die in it, whether I live through it? Have I got enough sense of his love for me and his desire to guide me through it that I don't have to stand in the face of uncertainty with fear? And I think that's where I want to encourage people, man. Yeah. And certainty, we were talking to someone last week, someone that's been through some traumatic stuff in their life, and they were caught between a job they wanted and couldn't get. It wasn't offered to them. They really felt good about it. And then there was another job they didn't feel good about. They were offered it, but they didn't really trust. And so Sarah and I were kind of walking them through this guy, you know, how do you deal with this? And just the whole thing is, I don't know. If you don't feel good about that one, don't take it. The fact that you didn't get the other one you wanted, let's just leave that in Jesus' hands. Now we're going to walk on and see what happens next, what unfurls. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she did take herself out of the one job that she thought was going to be. And the way she was feeling it in her gut was, this is a dangerous job. The guy she would be working with was not a safe guy to be with. And whether that gut check was right or not, we're never going to know for sure, but I thought it was right.
Yeah.
And then she's left with nothing, and she's got to move where she's got. She doesn't have income. She has no way to plan. And then I got an email from her this morning. The first job she wanted, the other person they selected turned it down. So it's come back to her. And I told her today, I said, what I want you to learn from that is not, oh, God, God save my bacon again. I want you to see that inside your heart, the Holy Spirit was communing with you. You had a gut check about the one, and you turned it down, and the thing you wanted went away, but you didn't then make that take the one you had negative feelings about. You held space for, okay, God, I don't know what's next, but we're going down that road. And then a day later, or 2 days later, this other job, maybe three, this other job offer comes through. And now she's just, oh, so happy. And yes, enjoy it. But the kind of faith that says, okay, I trust the Lamb to lead me wherever he wants me to go. And if these are those days in which the end of the age may come, or even if they're not, that sense of resilient faith in God's ability to negotiate any circumstance that comes my way. And I shared that as one of the things on my blog about my father's passing that my dad helped me really understand. At a very young age, I watched him stand and watch his entire crop from the year be destroyed by a deluge of rain. And we're standing on the patio with the rain beating down on the aluminum top above us. And all of a sudden I said, Dad, what are we going to do? Because we get one check a year as a farmer family. You don't get multiple checks. One check a year. It's all gone. He's going to plow it under. This is predating crop insurance. We didn't have any. He had some in ensuing years, but not that year. And I remember he didn't even look at me. He was just staring out at the crop and watching it. And I hurt for what I saw in his eyes. And he just says, Wayne, the Lord's always taken care of us. And I suspect he'll take care of us now. So is my faith in God's provision the fact that I have a farm and a crop, or that I have a God who is bigger than what else may go wrong? And I don't know how we got through. I mean, that crop being hauled in and being paid for it, that's paying your labor, everything for the next year. That's all of that. And I don't know. We ate that year. We didn't seem to change any of the normal things we did as a family. We tightened our belts a bit, but overall, nothing substantive changed. And that experience as a child for me, and I was probably a child, I was probably like 12-ish, 13-ish. I mean, that has stayed with me my whole life. When I read Habakkuk, when he talks about the Lord is my strength, if there are no cattle in the stall and no grapes in the vines, the Lord of God is my strength. And I think that's what we get to learn right now. I would encourage people who are listening to this, even the existential threats, if you go listen to this podcast, you'll find it very upbeat. You won't find it like a real downer and everything good, bad's going to happen, the whole world's it. It's not that. It's saying, here's the challenge we face as humanity. The next 100 to 150 years of our existence is going to be pivotal. I'm the one that's adding, you know what? We could be getting to the end of things. One of these existential things really come about. Then maybe God is at a very accelerated rate pushing humanity toward the end, because this experiment is not going well from God's side. Because one of the things I get out of this is the only way humanity can function is if we learn unselfishness.
Yeah.
And I don't know where we learn unselfishness outside of Christ. And I know most people who follow Christ still live selfishly. You know, Christ is a name to them. It's not a love for my fellow humanity. It's maybe love for my fellow team members, but not love for humanity as a whole, which is what the quote we start with, Malwork Schweitzer, is. We got to see all of us as a common humanity, and no matter where our belief systems differ, and we're in this together, and how do we... And I think that's the challenge for we followers of Christ. Are we going to be part of that voice in the culture to be unselfish, to understand, to love even people we disagree with? Or are we going to join the human parade into, I'm going to do what's best for me no matter who it hurts?
Yeah, I think that just really reminds me of some of the conversations that we really saw rising up in the midst of Christendom during COVID. And the different reactions and responses. And there was so much fear. There was so much fear mongering. I mean, 24/7, if you wanted to find fear, you could find it. plastered on your phone, on the TV yep. screen, wherever you wanted to find it.
Yep.
And yet it was like, man, dude, it was very unveiling of, is there a genuine hope in things unseen that are bigger than us, that we have found that that endurance, that fortitude, that, yeah, just that foundation, that when it's hard, when things come up like this, when we're faced with these existential things, are we sitting in a space of hope or not? Is that the essence that others are feeling and experiencing from us? Is there a rest, love, and play in the midst of unknown, uncertainty? You know, and because it's intriguing when you read that, when you read that quote, and it's from almost 70 years ago, right?
Yes.
And you think about that and you're like, wait a minute. You can take that a couple of ways. A, have we not learned, right? Like, okay, so 70 years ago, they're asking a lot of the same questions that we're asking ourselves today. Or it's interesting that we're the circles and the cycles that we go through. Like, for example, when he stated that quote, and we're dealing with this whole thing of nuclear power and whether or not, you know, we're going to use nuclear warfare to wipe out humanity, right? Then we're going, literally going, he's on the cusp of Vietnam and of some of the really interesting seasons of political corruption and things that were like, whoa, hold on a second. All of a sudden, some question marks are coming up and, you know, there's these riots that are taking place on college campuses and all these different things start to happen. And it's like, okay, Lord. And yet in all of that, your hope has continued to prevail. And there's been a stirring, a calling to the remnant in those days with what they needed for that season of time. And so what does that look like, Lord? What does that look like today?
Never a time when we're going to need to more clearly listen and follow. And not look for your answers from somebody else to tell you what to do. You, in yeah. your life, listen and follow. Let him develop not only a trusting heart towards him, but a generous heart toward others. Because yeah. if your hope is in humanity to resolve these existential risks, history says it's well misplaced there. But if it's not, as God spoke to David, not in horses and chariots, not in the strength of Israel, not looking for those places to be our hope, but to find our hope in him and him alone, this is a great time to learn that. Because like you said yeah. about the pandemic, man, it proved we were perfectly in the wrong place to manage a crisis of that size and do it together. We yes. couldn't. We even used yeah. that to tribalize and yeah. to bring and to discredit people. Not everybody looking for an answer that works, but everyone blaming each other for what didn't work.
Yeah.
And I don't think we learned anything from that that would set us well for the next crisis that may come. In fact, it seems like we just keep pulling the fabric of our society apart for personal gain, for feeling like my side gets to win over the bad side.
Oh, I have some friends that legitimately have chosen not to have kids because of the stuff that's going on in the world today. And them viewing it as inhumane to bring new life into the midst of the chaos. When you can't even feed your own, like, would you want to have any other, you know, it just, man.
And yet God needs people on the earth to live his light out in the darkness.
Yeah.
Needs it.
Yes.
Lord Jesus, come quickly. That's where I end up going at, you know, either way, I'm out of here in about 20 years. I don't know whether he comes to get me or whether I find my way home like dad, but, we'll find out in the days to come.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.